From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Attorney General Dana Nessel takes over an investigation of former U.S. Olympic women's gymnastics coach John Gettert.
I would say any and all potential crimes are being investigated. So I don't think there's going to be anything off the table.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell on life after losing her husband, John.
I can hear John in my ear saying, don't feel sorry for yourself. Get out there and get back to work. So I am.
Continuing our look into Michigan's mental health services for kids and teens.
Primary care docs really are doing a majority of this work, but many of them feel ill-equipped to do so. And most indicate that they're spending about 40% of their time on mental health issues.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we talk with Congresswoman Debbie Dingell about the loss of her husband, John Dingell, the longest-serving member of Congress, and his final last words to America.
This is something I heard from him 40 years we were together. He always worried about our democracy and protecting and preserving it. But I think he was worried about the fear and hatred that he saw in this country.
That conversation later in the hour. Plus, we'll continue looking into Michigan's mental health services for children and teens. Today, we explore the dearth of child and teen psychiatrists and just what's being done about it. But first, State Attorney General Dana Nessel today announced her office is now investigating complaints being leveled against one of the top gymnastics coaches in the country, John Gettert of Eaton County.
I would say any and all potential crimes are being investigated. So I don't think there's going to be anything off the table with that. And again, we welcome information from anybody that has information about John Gettert. And those tips will be followed up on and will be thoroughly investigated.
To talk about this, we're joined by reporter Allie Illich, who has been investigating John Gettert for more than 2 years. Allie, remind us again, just who is John Gettert?
John Gettert is the former Olympic coach. He led the Fierce Five to the 2012 Olympics. He led them to gold. And he's also the former owner of the popular gym Twistars in Diamonddale, one of the many places where convicted Dr. Larry Nassar worked for decades. Gettert and Nassar are also longtime friends who, according to many Nassar survivors, had a unique and special bond. During the sentencing hearings in Ingham and Eaton County, we heard that their relationship can be compared to Bonnie and Clyde.
And to that point, during Larry Nassar's sentencing hearings in early 2018 in Ingham and Eaton counties, we did hear a lot about John Gettert. Let's listen to what some of these survivors had to say about him.
The dynamic duo that is Larry Nassar and John Gettert had lasting effects on me that go beyond physical ones.
When I broke my knee inside of the gym, tore my hamstring, broke my tibia and fibula all in the same time, you sat there and you screamed at me and you called me a baby. You told me to get up and walk when my knee was broken.
To John Gettert, you are as much of a monster as Larry.
My teammates and I spent way too many days as innocent children, shaking, crying, trembling, some even trying to take their own lives because of you. Well, similar to what others have told Larry, I will say to you, those little girls that you treated like objects and things are all grown up now and are here to bring you hell.
And that was survivors Lindsay Lemke, Alexis Alvarado, Bailey Pickle, and Isabel Hutchins, all talking about their former gymnastics coach, John Gettert. Allie, when did Gettert first come to the attention of law enforcement?
That's what's interesting. So something to point out in this case is that Gettert has been on law enforcement's radar for many years. Police have investigated Gettert for assault on at least four other occasions dating back to 1986. Police records show that Gettert was accused of assault in 1990, 2011, and 2013. And let's talk more about the recent cases. In 2011 and 2013, in both of those cases, the Michigan State Police investigated Gettert for assault and battery. Charges were never brought. However, in the 2013 case, the Eaton County prosecutor, Doug Lloyd, said he had enough evidence to charge Gettert, but as part of a deal, he allowed him to seek counseling for anger management. So this investigation that the attorney general is taking over, that's in Eaton County right now, Gettert is accused of some of the same kind of abuse that he was investigated for back in 2013. And in fact, some of the women who tried to talk to police then are among those who are trying to get justice right now, but they feel like their concerns have fallen on deaf ears.
All right. And I know you have talked to some of these parents, including this mom.
I would just like someone to listen, to sit down and listen to us and to talk to the girls and see what they went through. And it's not just a tough coaching situation. You know, John's not just some tough coach. He's an abusive, narcissistic pig who finds great joy in tearing little girls apart. And it needs to stop.
This mom asked that we withhold her name. She's actually worried about jeopardizing her daughter's chances of getting justice. She also says she is worried about retaliation.
Our daughter had been stalked by John for a number of years after she left the gym, and he had actually sent me messages threatening me. So we actually said enough is enough.
So, Allie Illich, this mom and other parents have been asking the Eaton County prosecutor to charge John Gettert, and that hasn't happened?
It has not. And that's something that's important to point out here. Now, the investigation has taken a year. It's been a year now. But what's unfortunate is that in some cases, the statute of limitations has expired. So some of these women were told by prosecutors they can no longer get justice.
And we should point out, you did reach out to Eaton County Prosecutor Doug Lloyd, but you did not get a response back, correct?
I did not.
Which brings us to today's announcement by Attorney General Dana Nessel. What did she say about why she has decided to take over this investigation?
Dana Nessel said that she sat down with Doug Lloyd for several hours, and she said she respects him and came to the conclusion that the attorney general has more resources to take on this case than the Eaton County Sheriff's Office does. And so it was a coordinated effort, according to her, and, you know, it was handed over willingly.
I've got to imagine this is really trying for parents. We could hear that in that mom's voice.
It has been. Yes. A lot of the parents have grown frustrated over the, you know, several months. They've been waiting for answers. In fact, some of the parents said that they started making calls to the attorney general's office. They have been making calls to members of Congress asking for help with the case because they believe their concerns are being ignored, and some believe they're being covered up by those who are investigating on a local level. So last week, prosecutor's office and police from Eaton County, they hosted a meeting with some of the parents who have expressed concerns about the investigation, wanting an update on the status and what's going on. My point in saying that is that there has been a lot of tension between some of the parents who think, you know, I don't think enough is being done here, and the prosecutors and police saying, look, we're still investigating this. We've taken your reports. Kind of be patient with us.
And we should note here that our Michigan radio reporter, Lindsay Smith, did get a response from Eaton County Prosecutor Doug Lloyd today after Attorney General Nessel announced she was taking over the investigation. And it reads in part, I'm quoting him, "This transition was thoughtful, coordinated, and has my full support. The investigation is open and ongoing. Because my office is no longer reviewing the case, it would be inappropriate for me to comment further." We also reached out today to John Gettert, and we have not heard back at this point. So, Allie, where do things go now, and will the attorney general be able to do more than what's been done in the past?
It's a good question. I guess right now we're going to have to see. Time will have to tell. However, she did say today, when asked by reporter Kate Wells, if they're taking reports involving physical abuse, sexual abuse, kind of what is the scope here? And she said, we're taking anything and everything at this point. So it'll be interesting to see moving forward what happens.
And whether any more people come forward now that it's in the hands of the state attorney general.
Yes.
That is reporter Allie Illich, who has been reporting on these allegations against John Gettert for several years now. We want to thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us, Allie.
Thanks for having me.
Attorney General Dana Nessel also gave an update into the state's ongoing investigation into sexual abuse committed by Catholic priests in Michigan dating back to 1950. Michigan Radio Shana Roth is here with that part of the story. So, Shana, what did AG Nessel say as far as the status of the state's investigation right now?
that it's going to be a while, is the short end of it. She said that this investigation could take up to 2 years, that they are currently reviewing hundreds of thousands of documents that they seized during this simultaneous raid of all of the dioceses in the state back in October. So she says they are reviewing all of those documents. They are continuing to review the tips that have been submitted to their hotlines and to their offices. She says so far they've received about 300 tips. So this is really kind of just the start of what is probably going to be a very long investigation.
She also, I understand, delivered a very crystal clear message to the 7 Catholic dioceses in Michigan and to anyone who thinks they may have been abused. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so what she essentially said was, don't work with the churches on this, that she wants the churches to stop any sort of internal reviews that they might be conducting. And she wants people to go to law enforcement, not to the church, if they have any sort of abuse to report.
And what I would like to say to the public is this. If an investigator comes to your door and asks to speak with you, please ask to see their badge and not their rosary.
So that's pretty strong. It seems the Attorney General is pretty clear telling the church to quit with the self-policing.
Yeah, and this is something that is just kind of continuing to evolve. The Archdiocese of Detroit has already issued a statement, and they're saying that they have not been asked by Nestle's office to stop their internal review process, and they're saying that that they don't have any sort of self-policing, as Nestle has said. So it's unclear at this point just, you know, how much this request is going to affect the diocese across the state and what their total reaction is going to be. But up until this point, the dioceses have across the state have continued to release statements saying, look, we are on board. We are happy to help out. We are going to do whatever we can to help with this investigation.
And it is worth noting that anyone can report suspected abuse committed by clergy by going to the Attorney General's website or by calling that investigation hotline. The number is 844-324-3374. That number again is 844-324-3374. So again, as you say, a couple of years worth of work ahead, so we shouldn't expect any major developments in the state investigation.
Exactly.
Michigan Radio's Shana Roth reporting to us from Lansing. Shana, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, at least 1 in 5 Michigan children has some mental health disorder. But in 2017, our state had just 11 child and teen psychiatrists for every 100,000 kids.
We know that undertreatment of these illnesses is frankly catastrophic for a child's trajectory in life.
How this shortage of child psychiatrists is hurting Michigan kids and what we're doing about it. That's next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Deer hunting is on the decline in Michigan. In the late 90s, the number of people hunting deer in this state was just somewhere under 800,000. 20 years later, that number has dropped by a quarter. A new ban on deer baiting is likely to further that downward trend. But the DNR says this ban is necessary for the long-term health of Michigan's deer herd. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanchera has this story.
Just about every day, Larry Martin goes to FPS Archery Shop in Cadillac to shoot his bow. Right now, he's taking aim at a paper target about 20 yards away.
Best sound in the world right there.
Martin is 74 years old, and he says he deer hunts at his camp near Copemish.
I still climb trees and do it all the way I used to when I was young.
He says a ban on deer baiting really won't affect him since he doesn't hunt over a pile of bait, but he knows plenty of other hunters who do.
A lot of the older people that I know in my area up there, they're stuck to their bait piles. I know it's going to hurt them because you can't just go set a blind up in the woods and have deer come walking by it like you do if you put some corn out there.
At the end of January, a ban on deer baiting went into effect all across Michigan's Lower Peninsula. Its purpose is to stop the spread of chronic wasting disease among the state's deer herd. CWD is a neurological disease that spreads to other deer through contact with saliva, urine, and feces. Katie Keene is with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources.
Getting animals all coming into the same location, chewing on sugar beets or carrots or apples, going to the bathroom and eating in the same places, they can just contaminate each other.
So far in Michigan, 62 deer have tested positive for CWD, but in neighboring Wisconsin, the disease has spread to over 5,200 deer. DNR statistics show that over 50% of Michigan hunters used bait piles during the 2017 deer season. So Keene says a ban on baiting will contribute to a decline in deer hunting in the short term, but not doing something would have even more of a lasting impact.
We got to look at the big picture and how to manage responsibly.
You know, everything else I've got over here is just all my bow lines that I carry, arrows, crossbows.
Back at FPS Archery in Cadillac, shop owner Kim Fortelka has two reactions to the ban.
One as a hunter and one as a business owner.
Fortelka has owned the archery shop for the past 25 years. He says the bait ban has the potential to make for better hunting. Deer won't be influenced by large bait piles and will be more active throughout the day. He says baiting has conditioned some hunters to be lazy, and that style of hunting might be all they know.
Now, trying to teach people or re-educate people that they're going to have to work harder to get back into the successful range, there's a lot of people that just aren't willing to put that effort into it.
Which is why, as a business owner, he's very concerned business is going to go down. Combine the people who've never hunted without bait and older hunters who aren't as mobile, Fortelka estimates the deer bait ban could decrease his profits by 25%. Already, he says a few hunters who've had holds on new bows came in to say they changed their minds.
Because they hadn't seen many deer and they weren't going to be able to bait next year, so they didn't want to have their equipment, any new equipment.
A decline in Michigan's hunting economy means a trickle-down effect in other economies as well. Tourism, hospitality, and agriculture all stand to lose something if Michigan continues to lose hunters. Conservation funding in the state would also suffer as hunting licenses help pay for conservation efforts. Katie Keene of the Michigan DNR recognizes that. And she says new laws can be a gateway for innovation among hunting products.
Anytime we have some type of regulation change, you have to look for other avenues. Okay, so what am I going to do? And it seems like that's where product is developed. And all of a sudden, there's a new method or thing out there that gets people excited.
Keene says for hunting ultimately to thrive in Michigan, there needs to be a healthy deer herd, which is why the DNR says the bait ban is necessary.
And it hurts in the beginning, but we're looking at the goal in the end. To have hunters continue to hunt deer is very important. And so this might be hard for this year and maybe next season, but we're hoping people can see past that.
The deer bait ban in the Lower Peninsula is indefinite, but Keene says they have been reversed in the past. For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanshura.
A child in a psychiatric crisis is a terrifying challenge for parents. But then imagine not being able to find psychiatric care for your child. This is all too common. Earlier this week on Stateside, we explored a University of Michigan study that finds half the children and teens in this country who need treatment for a mental health problem are not getting it. One big reason: a severe shortage of child psychiatrists, like Dr. Sheila Marcus. She's a pediatric psychiatrist at C.S. Mott Children's Hospital at U of M, and she leads the Michigan Child Collaborative Care Program. This is a project to train primary care providers with psychiatric support skills. Dr. Sheila Marcus, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for doing this piece. I think it's such an important thing for all of us to know about.
And I think we're going to surprise people. So a Washington Post report finds there's an estimated one psychiatrist per 1,807 kids who need mental health care in the U.S. How dire is the shortage of child and adolescent psychiatrists in Michigan? How do we compare to other states?
So Michigan, like really every state in this country, is also in just desperate need for child psychiatrists. When we look at the counties in the state of Michigan, more than half of them, about 65, have no child psychiatrists. So really north of Clare, there are very few. There are a couple in Grand Traverse County, maybe one to serve the entire Upper Peninsula. But most children who are in the northern part and the rural part of the Michigan have no access to child psychiatrists. Even those who are served in the community mental health agencies only have access to telepsychiatrists.
So how did we get here? Why is there such a national shortage of child psychiatrists?
Well, you know, if you think about it, in some ways, it's a perfect storm. So in many pediatric subspecialties, there are too few specialists. But if you think about pediatric surgery, very few children need surgery in any given year. If you think about mental health issues, about one in five children will have an issue related to mental health, including anxiety and depression and learning issues and attentional issues. So it is a very, very common problem, and yet there are very few people who are specializing in this area.
Dr. Marcus, why is that? Why aren't people choosing to specialize like you did in child psychiatry?
Well, I think it's a variety of things. I think, like with mental illness in general, there's a bit of a stigma attached to going into the field. So I think that's a piece of it. I think because reimbursement is such that it's sort of tilted in the direction of funding procedural specialties more than cognitive specialties, the reimbursement for mental health has not been as strong. I think that in a place like Michigan, which is in the Midwest, because of this incredible shortage, people can choose to literally go to any city in any state in the country. So the majority of the child psychiatrists are clustered on the coast, and it's challenging, frankly, to recruit them to the Midwest.
And then you think about the consequences of this shortage. I want to dig into that and the challenge for parents who are seeking help. A mother from West Michigan knew we were having these series of conversations, and she emailed me to describe her family's experience when her then high school son had a sudden, very severe onset of depression and anxiety. And here's what she wrote me. I'm quoting her. We spent 2 days driving from Benton Harbor to South Haven, to Holland, back to South Haven, back to Grand Rapids, looking for a place that would treat him. Finally, she was told, okay, there's a place. It's in Detroit, 3 hours from home. And as she puts it, imagine having a heart attack and being told, you have to drive 3 hours for a hospital. Now, finally, they found a psychiatric hospital in South Bend, so they drove to Indiana. He was hospitalized and stabilized, but he needed outpatient psychiatric care. And this was in mid-March, and there were no appointments with anybody local until June. So this family wound up driving back and forth to South Bend for psychiatric care. He is doing well now, so that is the good news. But does their story surprise you at all?
Sadly, this mom's story does not surprise me at all. I'm reminded of a call I got from a primary care physician taking care of a child in the thumb area. And this grandmother said, I don't know what to do about this four-year-old. He's running into the street. I can't take care of him. I can't move this quickly. I'm going to have to hospitalize him. And they were going to take him across the state to Grand Rapids. And when I began to ask the question, not why is he behaving like this? But what happened to him? What I learned was that his mom was opiate addicted and his dad was in jail, and this child had witnessed significant domestic violence. And so this child was moved to the grandmother's care when he was age 3. So this child, who had been called bipolar and oppositional defiant disorder and who was already on 3 medications, didn't have any of those things. This was a child who had suffered from trauma. And this is a story that's way too common. It is very common for people to drive 2 or 3 hours. And unfortunately, it's also common for them to stay in the emergency room, sometimes for days at a time, waiting for a hospital bed to open. Those beds that are for teens who are depressed are frankly easier to find than for children who may have autism and aggression. Those beds are so-called ICU beds. So these are kids who may need additional nursing support to stay safe and to keep others safe around them. Those children can wait sometimes for weeks for a hospital bed to open up. And you would think that a place like Ann Arbor, which is one of the better served areas, could serve people quickly. But again, because people come to us from all over the state, our access is also challenging because we're serving people both from the region as well as from as far away as the UP.
Dr. Marcus, then what are the consequences of this limited access to mental health care for children and teens?
Well, we know that undertreatment of these illnesses is frankly catastrophic for a child's trajectory in life. So things like academic decline, inability to form comfortable intimate relationships, early pregnancy, it's associated with use of alcohol and drugs, and untreated illness in general increases rates of medical costs. So our medical colleagues will tell us all the time that because people are not getting adequate treatment for their mental health conditions, they're seeking inappropriate treatment for what they believe are cardiac conditions or GI conditions, when in fact treating their depression or anxiety would far better target the underlying issue.
Now, I know there's an attempt to address this shortage in child and adolescent psychiatrists through the program you lead, MC3, the Michigan Child Collaborative Care Program, been going on since 2012. What do you actually do in this program?
So the MC3 program is really an attempt to get child psychiatry expertise into every primary care office in the state of Michigan. So what we provide are both phone-based and telepsychiatric consultations for primary care physicians throughout the state. So we're aware that primary care docs really are doing a majority of this work, but many of them feel ill-equipped to do so, and most indicate that they're spending about 40% of their time on mental health issues. So we've been able to hire behavioral health consultants who are sort of our boots on the ground throughout the state. Primary care physicians can call that individual who will in turn get us questions, and we will respond to the primary care physician on the same day with answers, not just about what medicines to use, often that's what people think about, but it's really to teach them how a child psychiatrist thinks, to think about what might this child be experiencing, what's the differential diagnosis here, what kinds of therapy might be useful, what kinds of self-help programs or concepts would be helpful for a child. One of our largest findings is that many children are being inappropriately medicated and inappropriately diagnosed with conditions that are really related to trauma. And so we are attempting to get better trauma-informed care into the hands of our practitioners. But it's really to help support primary care colleagues and teach them evidence-based care for common children's mental health conditions.
Is MC3 a foundational fix, or is this a bandage over a deeper problem?
Well, I think it is an attempt to begin to support primary care docs, particularly with mild to moderate conditions. In a perfect world, we would have enough specialized child psychiatrists to serve children who had more moderate to severe illness. I don't see that happening, at least within the next decade or so, because our attempts to recruit people locally are just so very challenging. But I do think that working together with primary care, you can really form a network of providers and begin to funnel the most severe cases to child and adolescent psychiatrists for direct treatment, and mild to moderate conditions to primary care with support for treatment. If you think about our continuum of care, with the bottom of the triangle residing in primary care for mild conditions and the top of the triangle residing in specialty care, I think that's really a model that could work for the state and for many of the states in our country.
Dr. Marcus, what would you say to parents like the mom who wrote to me and said, I know many others who are in the same position, have similar stories to tell, a child in crisis, and they can't find any help nearby? What do you say to them?
Well, I think number one, we hear you. I think that this is a crisis that is beginning to reach the highest levels, both within the state, within the university, within academic centers, and within primary care centers. And people are beginning to put their heads together to say, this isn't right, this isn't fair, it's not good for these parents, it's not good for these children. So things are beginning to change. Number two, thank you. Thank you for your advocacy on the part of your children. Your children are the lucky ones who have parents such as you that are reaching out on their behalf. Number three, be persistent. Things do change. Things change day to day across emergency rooms. So make certain that you're calling several centers. In the case of waiting lists, put your child on every waiting list that you can. People who are diligent and call frequently do tend to get moved up. And number three, know that we're trying. It is not that we don't hear you or don't want to attend to this. I think we are struggling with resources that are just far too scarce. Make your voices known. I know that at the state level, we're working with advisory groups that include parents. So we want to know what are the issues and what this feels like from your vantage point.
And what else should we be doing to address the shortage of children and adolescent psychiatrists in Michigan and really across the country?
I think beginning to speak to both legislators and others in graduate medical education programs around the importance of supporting these specialties so that we can recruit additional people. I think the public health crisis and giving voice to it as we are here and in national newspapers will begin to help. I think beginning to disseminate information and get it into schools, into communities, to police. And I think working together, I think having primary care physicians and clinicians working with specialists together so that we can sort of link arms and take care of kids will be a piece of this puzzle. But it's a big challenge.
Dr. Sheila Marcus, pediatric psychiatrist with C.S. Mott Children's Hospital, and she leads the Michigan Child Collaborative Care Program. Dr. Marcus, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And after the break, we meet a filmmaker from mid-Michigan who is heading to the Oscars. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In February 2011, Sam Davis was just a few months away from graduating from Potterville High School. 8 years later, he will be putting on his tuxedo for Sunday night's Oscars. That's because the mid-Michigan native photographed and edited a film that's nominated for an Academy Award. It's called Period, End of Sentence. This short documentary takes us to a small rural Indian village where women and girls face hardships surrounding menstruation. They have no access to feminine hygiene products so readily available to women elsewhere. Sam Davis is here with us now. Sam, welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that intro.
What was that moment like, and when you discovered we were nominated? Did you have any reason to think that would happen?
It was an incredible moment. We all gathered around at 5 in the morning because they announced the nominees at 8 a.m. Eastern time, so everyone was half asleep. But, yeah, it was a moment I'll never forget, for sure.
And then since then, what has it been like in these weeks since the Oscar nominations came out leading up to Sunday night?
It's been incredible. You know, it's a campaign, and in a lot of ways it's similar to a political campaign. You know, you're meeting Academy members and voters, and it's kind of a full-time whirlwind of publicity and events since nominations came out.
Sam, what led you and the team to this story of how installing a machine to make sanitary pads changed the lives of women and girls in this village?
Yeah, so the groundwork for the project was laid by an English teacher in Los Angeles named Melissa Burton, who, with her class, through this status on the Commission of Women at the United Nations, discovered that women in developing countries like India were dropping out of school when they got their periods. And there's an organization at that school in Los Angeles called Girls Learn International. And they sort of made it their mission to do something to change that. And they thought, what better way to get the word out than to make a documentary?
Every day around the world, girls my age face barriers to receiving an education.
Poverty, violence, and cultural norms are key reasons.
But did you know that in many countries, including our own, girls miss school for another reason? Menstruation.
Now, tell us who the director is.
So the director is Rekha Zatabji, who's also my girlfriend, and we went to school together. We met at USC School of Cinematic Arts in 2014, and we've worked together on pretty much every project since then.
So we have a woman who's a director, but there you were, yep, a man behind that camera. How did that work?
I think the thing that saved me was our subjects knew that I couldn't speak Hindi. So, you know, it was difficult enough to have these women open up about a topic that they've never talked about in their entire lives to anyone. So, you know, that was a question going into it, was if my presence in the room would make them even more nervous to talk about something so taboo. And fortunately, it kind of became more of an icebreaker, I think, than anything, because, you know, we would tell them that I couldn't understand anything they were saying anyway. And it usually led to some laughs.
I went to your website, to samdavisdp.com, and I have to say, your demo reel is striking. You have this gorgeous way of using light in your shots. And it got me wondering, how and when did you begin to be drawn first to photography and then to editing?
My first exposure to anything official in the film industry was in 2012, right when I graduated from Potterville High School. That was the height of Michigan's film incentive. And there was a movie that was shooting in Ann Arbor, and I got to intern as a camera PA, and it was kind of at that point where I realized that that's really what I wanted to do.
So you started your career when the Michigan film industry was kind of growing because of the now defunct Film Incentive Program.
Definitely, and you can imagine for a kid who grew up dreaming of becoming a filmmaker, it was a really exciting time for being an aspiring filmmaker in Michigan with all these productions, you know, right down the street. The Batman movie was shooting, and it was incredible to see all these productions coming to my home state. And I still, to this day, credit a lot of the opportunities that I've had to that very first experience of mine, which was working as a production assistant on a movie called Love and Honor in Ann Arbor.
You wouldn't be probably going to the Oscars so very few years after graduating from high school, to be honest.
That's actually true, because quite literally, the co-writer and producer of that movie sort of took me under his wing, and fast forward 5 years, and he's the producer of the documentary that is nominated. So I ended up making a movie with the producer of the first movie I ever PA'd on, which is pretty cool.
Pretty cool way to close that circle. And I know you're actually intending to shoot a feature film in Potterville?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I'm developing a project called Sense, C-E-N-T-S, like multiple pennies, that's based on the 2002 Potterville, Michigan train derailment. This was pretty much the first time anyone had ever heard of my hometown. It made national headlines, and there's a train that was carrying liquid propane and sulfuric acid, and it derailed, and it forced this week-long citywide evacuation in Potterville, because if it had sparked, it would have been like a mushroom cloud situation and potentially wiped out a good part of my hometown. So the story, it's a feature film, and it's a coming-of-age story about a kid who thinks he caused that train derailment, and the whole town evacuates, and he has to stay behind and sort of grow up on his own in my abandoned hometown. So it's historical nonfiction, and it's a film that I wrote, and it'll be my first feature as a director.
Well, that is definitely a story that I would like to see on a screen. And Sam Davis, who grew up in Potterville in mid-Michigan, the photographer and editor on the Oscar-nominated short documentary, Period, End of Sentence. Thanks, Sam, for your time, and good luck at the Oscars.
Thank you so much.
In the days following her husband's death, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell was omnipresent, greeting people at the public visitation in Dearborn, going through two funeral masses, and then laying John Dingell to rest at Arlington National Cemetery. In an emotional Facebook post, the congressman wrote, "He did tell me not to cry and that I had work to do." And that is what she's doing. Here with us now is Dearborn's Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. Welcome back to Stateside.
good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And I know it's only been 13 days since John passed, but here you are talking to us. You are getting back to work. You're going to meetings. How did you know it was time to kind of turn your energies back to Congress and to the job?
Well, I think I don't really have a choice. The people of the 12th District elected me to serve them. And I can hear John in my ear saying, don't feel sorry for yourself. Get out there and get back to work. So I am.
And there you are. And as you were right in the middle of saying farewell to your husband last week at Arlington Cemetery, President Trump declared that national emergency to get the money he wants to build his wall. And we hear that House Democrats may soon file a resolution to block him from doing that. And of course, that's expected to pass. But even if there are enough GOP defections in the Senate to also pass a resolution, President Trump promises he's going to use his first veto to block it. Do you see any chance that Congress would override that promised veto?
You know, I think this is a real constitutional crisis now in our country. You know, there are three branches of government, executive branch and the congressional branch have very clear roles, and there is a system of checks and balances, and the president has overstepped what the Constitution sets out. The congressional branch sets the budget. Now, there are many Republicans that, and the Senate particularly, who have expressed their concern about what he did and have warned him not to do it. I have signed on to the Castor Amendment, or the Castor Resolution, which will be introduced tomorrow, and Nancy will bring to the floor very quickly. I don't know if it'll be next week or the week after. I'm not that back into this work yet, but it will pass the House, but I suspect it will pass the Senate, as you said, and the question is, will there be enough votes to override a veto? And I don't know. I simply don't know. I think this is also going to end up in the courts. But this is not good for this country. We need to stop dividing ourselves. We've got to find a way that we work together better. This is a real constitutional crisis for us.
I also want to pivot over to the fact that you are the co-chair of the House Medicare for All Caucus, and we're hearing a new Medicare for All bill will be introduced soon. How soon do you think that might happen?
I think it'll happen next week. It was supposed to have happened the week that John died, so we postponed it. And I think it's very important. I think that every American's got a right to quality, affordable health care. You know, I know I'm luckier. John and I were luckier than 99 9/10 of the people in this country. And many of the experiences that we had, knowing that we're luckier than most, really do show you how broken our health system is. So establishing one entity, Medicare, to ensure that all Americans have access to it, would it help address the issue? It would improve the efficiency for providers who don't have to manage multiple insurance plans. It would let doctors and nurses focus more on treating patients than having to manage all the paperwork from countless insurance plans. And it would reduce the administrative costs, which are significantly lower in the traditional Medicare than private insurance plans. And we need to do something about it. I'll tell you something. John told me this is something you got to bring over the finish line, and I'm very committed to. I'm not quite sure what form it takes, how we get it there, but I know that every American's got a right to go to the doctor when they need to go to the doctor and not worry whether they can afford it or afford their medicine.
How do we pay for it?
Well, you know, one of the ways is just if you go to a single-payer system, you eliminate all the money that's being put into all of this paperwork in this very bureaucratic system right now.
So it certainly needs to be, there's going to be a lot of dinging and a lot of thrashing out for you to get it across that finish line.
But that's what a good bill does. It takes a lot of people working together. You know, the first universal health care bill was introduced in the early 1940s. We got Medicare in 1965 because people finally looked at the number of seniors that were totally destitute, living in poverty, and we needed to do something. As Americans, we were embarrassed by that. The program that followed after that was the Children's Health Insurance Plan because we all finally recognized that we need to make sure our children get the treatment that they need. So we got to do it right. We got to get a lot of opinions. We got to listen to people. We do have to figure out how we're going to pay for it. But I do believe by reducing the bureaucratic structure and going to one single payer, you will save probably almost as much money as you need to pay for it.
Congresswoman, there were so many extraordinary moments in those days surrounding John Dingell's death. And one was that opinion piece, My Last Words for America, published in the Washington Post. And am I correct, dictated to you on the very day he passed?
Well, he was having a difficult time writing a little, but he knew what he wanted to do. And he actually started telling us that this is the message he wanted read at his funeral. He had started dictating to me on Wednesday, and then he kicked me out of the room. He said, "Woman, get out of here." And he dictated a portion of the piece to Christine, who was a wonderful friend who stayed with him when I was in Washington, though we were both there that day. And I kept saying, "John, Christine's got to get a break. Christine's got to get a break." And then Michael Duffy, who's a friend from the Washington Post, emailed me and said, "Would John like to do an op-ed?" And I showed him the note, and he said, "Woman, let's go." And yeah, he dictated it the day he died.
What do you think he wanted all Americans, from the highest levels of power to everyday people, to take away from his message?
I think that there were several things. I mean, first, that we've become way too partisan, and he's worried about the division he sees in this country, that we're at a precipice, and that our democracy, this is something I heard from him 40 years we were together, he always worried about our democracy and protecting and preserving it. But I think he was worried about the fear and hatred that he saw in this country, and that people working together had accomplished great things. You know, I didn't even know him. I was like, 2 years old when he started realizing we had to clean up our water. And when you look at the clips from the 60s, he was widely denounced when he introduced the first, the Clean Water Act to clean up our waters, that we need to protect and preserve our environment. He talked about Medicare, which he was one of the authors of and fought hard for many years. We can do great things together. We need to listen to each other. We have different perspectives. He often used to say, God gave us 2 ears and 1 mouth for a reason. We need to listen to each other, and that compromise isn't a dirty word.
There was another extraordinary moment, and that was the public visitation in Dearborn on that Monday, the 11th. More than 1,600 people came to say goodbye to him, and there you were for nearly an entire time, and you were greeting people for hours. What did you take away from those moments with the public? What did you hear?
I was stunned at the turnout. I, again, cannot tell you how wonderful the fire and police were. John loved them. They were good friends. They have many stories, and they got me through a very difficult day. But the diversity of people from all communities, all walks of life, and everybody had a Dingell story. You know, some of them were very funny. He really was a very funny man. He had helped so many people. I cannot tell you how touched I was by everybody coming and saying their goodbyes and sharing their stories. It meant a lot. And I could hear my ear, and if he had been there, he would have shaken every hand, and I was going to shake every hand.
And when you think of all of that week, the outpouring of tributes, the funeral masses, burial at Arlington, what moment do you think would have pleased John Dingell most of everything?
You know, I think he would have been surprised at the outpouring. He was always, didn't think he had done a good enough job. Anybody who came in, he had asked if he had done a good enough job, or his Twitter's okay. There were just so many, the outpouring in Dearborn was absolutely incredible, the mass there. He always told me he wanted to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery, and I think he was afraid that I wouldn't do it. I think I love Michigan and Michigan's home, so he even said to Christine, make sure I'm buried. Make sure she buries me at Arlington National Cemetery. And right when he was buried, 2 perfect V's of geese flew over. So Fred Upton called it the missing bird formation, but it was sort of a, that was hard. I got to tell you, that was very hard, but I think that would have made him happy. But the other thing that I think would have really touched him is the mass, as you know, the planes couldn't get in on Tuesday. So the mass at Holy Trinity, which is on the Georgetown campus, and both John and I are at Georgetown. John's a Georgetown prep, Georgetown undergraduate, Georgetown law school graduate, and I'm Georgetown undergraduate and graduate. But there were more than 160 of his colleagues, Republican and Democrats, from the House and Senate there. And Nancy Pelosi leaned over and said to Steny, Steny told me this later, Debbie was absolutely right. Everybody paused and came together, not as Republicans or Democrats, but as friends in a community. And community is the strength of democracy. And I think, you know, the other, when it was a really hard week, it was a very touching week, when he drove by the Capitol Plaza for one more time. It was also, you know, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell were out there with the leadership of the House. Nancy Pelosi was incredible throughout this, but Kevin McCarthy's words on the floor of the House were wonderful, too. When someone said to me, I've never seen Mitch McConnell show emotion before that day. You know, we're human people. The institution of Congress is made up of human people. Maybe that's something we all need to, we're representative government. We represent the people. And we do have a great form of government, and we got to protect it every day.
12th District Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Bella Isaac, Sarah Leeson, Katie Raymond, Tyler Scott, and Razi Joffrey. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.